Today is December 29th, 2017. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library. I'm actually in my house, and my interviewee, Martin Zach Rosen, is in his home in Carmel Valley, and we are having a FaceTime interview. Martin Rosen is a retired attorney. Martin, you're a rebel with a cause.
I am.
And a conservationist, yes?
That's true. All that's true.
Well, Martin, I just want to first of all say thank you so much for taking the time out of your life to share your personal story with the Mill Valley Historical Society. Yours is a really interesting and important story, and one that can inspire and motivate others, I think. So first of all, just thank you.
Well, no thanks really are required. I frankly feel gratified and redeemed, if not rewarded, by the opportunity to do the work that I've been called on to do.
Great. Well, let's get a little backstory about your family to begin, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear a little bit about how you came to California. If you could tell me a little bit about, maybe we can start with your grandparents, or as far back as you know, very briefly, their names, where they're from, and what brought you to California?
And that's part of the business of being lucky. It's a fairly straightforward story. My dad was born on the Russian-Polish border in a small village, probably in Poland, who went back and forth, called Kamen Krzyzierski. He immigrated to this country before World War I. We can find no record of his entering the country, and therefore we conclude that he probably was a stowaway. My mother, on the other hand, came after a violent pogrom in the Ukraine. She was one of several members of a family that came as a family. They settled in the Midwest, and then after the youngest of the siblings graduated high school in Omaha, my grandmother, Bessie, who was working 7 days a week as a single parent to support her six children, heard there were better jobs and better weather in California, so she brought her family to Los Angeles. My dad, in the meantime, having been a soldier in World War I and wounded, returned to New York, where he was drafted, and in the rainstorm changed a tire in New York City for a man who was grateful and offered him a tip or a bonus. And Dad said, no, thank you. It's just a good chance to do some good work. And the man, whose name was Michael O'Donnell, said, if you ever come to California, you'll get a job. So that led my dad to climb on a train. He came to Los Angeles, where he met my mother. They settled in Los Angeles, and my brother and I, Larry, were born in Los Angeles. My brother in 1929, and myself in 1931. And the reason I start off by saying lucky, it's really kind of the American story writ large. Neither of my parents went to college. I'm not sure my dad finished elementary school. Mom did finish high school in Omaha. But each of us knew from the first day that our future was wrapped up in the American dream and in education. My brother later went on to become a distinguished neuroradiologist from Northwestern University, and I was lucky enough to go to UCLA on a scholarship from the LA Times, and then later to UC Berkeley in the law school on several scholarships as well. So we had, we worked hard, everybody worked hard, but we've been more than amply rewarded by the American way of life.
Would you mind telling me the names of your grandparents and your parents, their full names?
Well, the truth is we did not know my father's family hardly at all until after World War I, when he found one of his relatives had escaped from Dachau. My mother's single family situation, her name, maiden name was Savad, S-A-V-A-D. My dad's family name was always Rosen, not Rosenstein, not Rosenberg, Rosen, R-O-S-E-N, and that's all I really know on that side, because I never met my dad's family, except after World War I, I met one of his younger sons. of one of his younger brothers.
So were you raised with Judaism as a religion?
Absolutely. Both my brother and I were bar mitzvah. My dad helped found and build one of the, physically build one of the synagogues in Los Angeles, Beth Abraham. And my brother was bar mitzvah there. We then later on moved to West L.A. from East L.A. And I was bar mitzvah at the Olympic Jewish Center just outside of Olympic and La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Hmm. So to California, somehow or another, your family made their way to California, but you were raised in L.A., but you lived in the Bay Area. You came here. Well, how did that happen? Because of your school?
Well, we both went through UCLA, graduating Los Angeles High School. Larry then went on to Northwestern, and I went on to Berkeley after graduating from UCLA. And I stayed in the Bay Area after graduating from law school. After going to Europe as a Ford Fellow, studying the common market, and after serving in the U.S. Air Force, as I mentioned earlier, in the San Joaquin Valley.
So how was it for you growing up in L.A.? What was your experience like there as a child?
It was all positive. We lived in a East L.A. neighborhood, which was fairly close, and face-to-face, we knew pretty much everybody. That was really before and then during the age of building the freeways. Later, going on to L.A. High and then to UCLA, it was a very positive experience. I learned for want of a better word, disparagement, when I practiced law after coming back from the service and so forth, that people in the Bay Area really had a very patronizing attitude toward Los Angeles. They couldn't believe that anyone was happy growing up in Los Angeles with all of the freeways and the pollution and so forth. And like so many other things, I discovered that we all have biases, prejudices that we really don't recognize. But it came as quite a surprise to my colleagues in Northern California that I had anything positive to say about Los Angeles.
Did you find the same for Los Angeles to San Francisco? Did people in Los Angeles have attitude about the Northern California folk?
Truth is, they, at least in my experience, you never really thought about San Francisco very much. Mm-hmm. San Francisco is kind of a special city. It was called the city. But we, frankly, had our own interests, and we never, at least in my case, never thought very much about San Francisco. Of course, we at UCLA knew there was a place called Berkeley and there was a place called Stanford because we played football, etc. But other than that, they were kind of abstract.
Did you enjoy the open spaces in LA?
Absolutely. The Angeles Forest, the beaches, were all very major, important places, as was the areas adjacent to our growing up. The San Fernando Valley, Verdugo Hills, Santa Barbara. There's an awful lot of truly magnificent open space. And the Trust for Public Land probably had its first, under Hugh Johnson, its first major acquisition in Los Angeles. A lot of people didn't realize that. Later on, of course, we went on to buy the land underneath the Hollywood sign on the Hollywood Hills, which was added to Griffith Park Observatory. So like anything else, if you go behind what you think you know, you have a chance of learning a lot of things that you wish you knew better. So, yes, there was. And the other part of it was, of course, Yosemite wasn't that far. And that was, frankly, a place that we got to know well, got to love. And, of course, when I was in the service in the San Joaquin Valley, being a serviceman, that was Yosemite's literally our backyard. And we got to know the Merced River and Tuolumne Meadows, and a whole host of things about Yosemite that became very, very important, and still to this day are very important.
So you learned to fly in Merced?
Well, I actually was not an aviator. I was a judge advocate, but I represented a lot of military people, and one of the things that they wanted was to organize an aero club or a flying club, and that's what I did at Castle Air Force Base. And in return for my, quote, legal services, I was given free flying lessons. And that's where I learned to fly. Taylor Crafts, Piper Cubs, Beach Rap Finances, things like that. Small, recreational airplanes.
And may I ask who your flight instructor was?
I say it once more.
Who was your flight instructor?
My flight instructor was a staff sergeant, great big fella, who taught me the basic rule of flying. When it's not safe to go ahead, turn around and go back.
Yes, there's a
fellow... That's what I learned about flying.
That's really good advice, too.
It was.
So simple and so important. Because I've interviewed...
But a lot of people, you know, get to be macho. They get in an airplane and you're showing off and stretching things, either with your fuel or your skill or your weather. And I always remembered, actually, he was a technical sergeant. I can see his face. He said, when it's not safe to go ahead, don't be embarrassed. Turn around and go back.
I ask you who your flight instructor was because I interviewed a fellow named Bill Mason here in Mill Valley. And he and his brother taught flight, too, during World War II. And there was a flight school in the Valley that they were involved with. So I just thought I'd give it a try.
But it's worth a try. But in this case, he was a regular Air Force tech sergeant. And he, of course, belonged to the Aero Club, as we call it, the Castle Air Force Base Aero Club. And he wasn't a full-time instructor. He was a pilot, and he was happy to teach other people such as me.
Growing up in L.A. as you did, and even spending time in the Valley as you did, you you must have seen a lot of changes in the land as far as development went,
City. That's very true, and of course, that's how I developed my vocabulary. I don't think that words are everything, but that words are very important. Most development, in my view, having grown up in Los Angeles, is not development. It's exploitation, and it's, quote, conversion. It's dollars per square foot. It's density. So when people call themselves developers, quite often, I have to tell you, I bristle. Not that they're bad people, but that they're misdescribing their work. And, of course, I saw a lot of that in Los Angeles rapidly. Fortunes were made. Communities were upended, and a lot of destruction was made there and in the Bay Area in the name of so-called progress. And that eventually will get us to the subject of Maranchello, which is where I cut my teeth as a conservation person in Marin County, taking on the Board of Supervisors and the Pacific Sun and the Independent Journal, all of whom felt that we needed more high-rise development in the name of progress. And obviously, that did affect me deeply.
Mm-hmm. So let's start heading in that direction. You went to school at Berkeley. You were in the East Bay, but did you make your way over to Marin County after school? Where did you open your practice?
I went back to San Francisco. I practiced at 111 Sutter in downtown San Francisco. Frankly, the practice was not what I wanted it to be, so I left the downtown San Francisco practice and returned to Merced in private practice and did what I called being a Cal County lawyer, which I frankly enjoyed. Trading eggs and things for fees was routine. Learning how to hunt for frogs and eating frogs' legs out of the canals. But the truth was, when I had a chance to open my own office, when a colleague was appointed to the bench in downtown San Francisco, that's literally when I moved into the Bay Area, set up my own practice in the Russ Building, and went into private practice in San Francisco on my own.
And what year is this?
Pardon me?
Do you know what year this is?
Pretty close, sure. I was in the United States Air Force from 1958 to 1960, came back to San Francisco and then to Merced practicing until 1962-63, and then I opened up my own office in 1963, thereabouts, in San Francisco, and moved to Mill Valley, actually to Homestead Valley, on Molino Street.
Oh, do you remember the address?
I know it's right after the turn, but I don't remember the address. It's in the valley. It's before the Mont Tamalpais slope occurs. It's down low, right near the 2 a.m. club.
Ah, yes.
That's where my bus stop was, literally in front of the 2 a.m. club on Miller Avenue in downtown Homestead Valley,
and that's
which was unincorporated.
Yeah, so you were on the flats right there. You were able to...
I was in the flat.
Ah.
I was in the flat. Pretty close to where Whole Foods, I guess, now is on Miller Avenue, if it's still there.
Yes, it's still there. And once it was Jerry's Meat Market.
Before then, it was Jerry's Meat Market, and it was that across the street. And we went through all of that. And both of my children attended Homestead School. Both of my children attended Tamalpais High School and later went on to graduate. My daughter from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Marika, M-A-R-I-K-A, and my son Dirk, who graduated from Santa Barbara, and we just saw this weekend, he is still actively pursuing his conservation passion, which is the ocean, and is the head of a small nonprofit based in Point Richmond called MARE, Marine Applied Research and Exploration, which is essentially documenting the biological realities, change, and stability of the California coastline from Mexico to Oregon.
That sounds very interesting. I guess nut didn't fall far from the tree,
It's the truth is we're still collaborating.
That's beautiful. So this is now you're in the 60s living in Mill Valley.
Right. My son was born in the service in 1958 and my daughter in Merced in 1961.
And how did you find Mill Valley at that time to be as?
Well, we have a very active partnership. My wife found Mill Valley. I frankly enjoyed life in Berkeley, having gone to law school and so forth. And Joan, my wife Joan, also a graduate of UCLA, made the decision for us, as she did for our moving to Carmel Valley. She makes the choices about where we live. And so she picked Mill Valley, and we lived on Molino, as I said, to begin with, in Homestead Valley. That would have been in 1963, thereabouts.
And how long did you stay?
Well, we lived in Marin County probably 40 years. So we lived in Homestead Valley on Rydell. We built a house constructed by the Little Jim Construction Company, Rydell, just up the road from Homestead School. And that then we moved from there to actually into the city of Mill Valley, and we lived on Lee Street, 70 Lee Street in Mill Valley.
Ooh, one of my favorite streets.
Yes, Ed Ross was our next-door neighbor, and of course he's pretty well known as a leading scientist at the California Academy of Sciences.
Yes, with his bug collection in those bunkers.
You,
I've been there.
Yes, yes, and of course he was a wonderful neighbor. He did a lot of the work looking after the land on which he lived and on which we lived literally next door. A wonderful neighbor.
Yes, very close to my house with beautiful, beautiful views and the
yes.
most serene, quiet neighborhood. Really, one
yes.
of the hidden treasures neighborhoods of
yes.
Mill Valley.
Yes.
Huh.
And it was through Ed Ross that we actually found the lot that my wife pursued with a colleague of Ed Ross who had a sabbatical, I think, at the California Academy of Sciences. And Ed arranged that we were to buy the lot from this colleague who had thoughts of perhaps settling one day in California, changed his mind. And when he did, Ed said, well, why don't you sell to this young couple, Marty and Joan Rosen? He did. And that's where we ultimately lived in Mill Valley before we moved to Kentfield, where we moved to 70 Lancaster in Kentfield.
And here in Mill Valley on Lee Street, not too far from someone you'd be working with, Doug Ferguson.
We saw Doug regularly. We're very close friends, and Louie and Huey Johnson as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go forward now and into Marinchello. This has just got to be one of the most important stories in this, well, there are many stories. I won't say the most important, but an important story. The what could have been is spine-chilling, and the what happened is a relief and an example, I should say, to what can, you know, how a world can be, despite what
yes.
developers may Macy, and then there's the people. So why don't you, if you could, just tell me a little bit about how that whole thing came about for you and how you became involved. And as if you could, you know, there'll be some people that will be listening to this interview and they won't know the story of Marin Chelo. So maybe you can give a little overview about that.
Okay. We're talking about a couple of thousand acres of land adjacent to Sausalito, much of which later became part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. The particular land that was to become Marin Chelo, however, being private, was sold to an Eastern Development Syndicate as well as Gulf Oil to develop fairly intensely in what I would call an Eastern mode. There were going to be more than a dozen high-rises, 15 or 16 stories tall. There was going to be a shopping mall. There were going to be all kinds of industrial and quasi-industrial as well as residential uses, and transform that entire area of a couple of thousand acres into an urban, in effect, city, Marin Chelo. It was challenged by a couple of conservation groups, primarily in southern Marin, who hired two lawyers, both of whom I knew, Bob Kahn and Dick, I'll think of his name in a minute, who also had some ties to official representation of the county of Marin. When it was learned that these two lawyers were going to challenge the decision of the Board of Supervisors, who had approved the high-rise development and everything else connected to it, they were called into county offices and essentially threatened very clearly that if they persisted in challenging the authority of the Board of Supervisors to bring progress and development to Marin County, they would lose any opportunity to work with the county in any official capacity. When I heard that from people that I knew, namely my classmate, Bob Kahn and Dick, I was outraged. I said, you know, that's politics in the rawest, crudest, cruelest sense that I'm used to reading about in Louisiana, but not in California, let alone my home county of Marin County. So I agreed to substitute in as lawyer for the people challenging the county decision, along with another excellent lawyer named Robert Preitzel. So Dick and Bob transferred out, and Bob Preitzel and I took over the litigation challenging the county of Marin's decision to proceed in the name of, quote, progress. And quite frankly, changing forever the character of Southern Marin. Bob and I proceeded to try the case to give the people of Marin County the right to vote on this land change from agricultural to intense urban development. Make a long story short, there was not one lawsuit, there were several lawsuits, both of which were tried in Marin County. The first lawsuit had to do with the right of the people to vote. Should the people of Marin County be able to vote on whether or not to transform this agricultural land into high-intensity urban development? That case went up all the way to the California Supreme Court after a lengthy trial in County Court, Superior Court of Marin County under the Honorable Joseph Wilson. Make a long story short, we lost that lawsuit in the California Supreme Court. However, the real hero of the legal battle for Marin Chelo was Robert Preitzel. Robert Preitzel persisted with the second lawsuit, which was extremely technical, and challenged the manner in which the notices of the change in the development were prosecuted and published. And that prevailed. That mastery of the detail of municipal law by Robert Preitzel demonstrated to the appellate court of the state of California, not the Supreme Court, but the District Court of Appeal, that the county of Marin basically denied due process to the people of Marin. And on that finding, the approval of the developers of Marinello were canceled and voided. By then, time having passed, personalities and money issues having surfaced, the Marinello project was abandoned by Gulf Oil and the commercial development in the east. At that point, then, Huey Johnson in the Nature Conservancy made a transaction with Gulf Oil, who put up all the money, to purchase the land, which was ultimately then transferred to the National Park Service, and that parcel is now part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area to be enjoyed by all generations for all posterity.
It all seems so tidy when you talk about it now, but the point that Robert Pritzel made, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, was
yes.
that the people had, it was Gulf Oil and the developers had to give, was it 10 days advance notice in the newspapers?
That's correct.
Before, so that people would be able to basically get the information and supply their input as they wanted, and in fact, the development company had only given 7 days.
That is, I think that is actually specifically correct. The long and the short of it was the notice was deemed inadequate. And of course, the developer said, well, really, what difference would it make? Nobody reads those notices anyway. And happily, Pritzel persuaded the court is that's not the question. The law is in charge. No one is above the law. And it was very specific. How many days notice are required? It isn't how many people read the notice or how many people should have read the notice, but the law was very specific, and the court agreed with him that due process was not given, and the transaction of county approval voided.
It's the irony is beyond belief when you think about it, because I mean this is the part where you want to be, you know, you have to know the local laws, but I mean this is a couple of days. Who even knows
That's right.
these things? Obviously not.
That's right. And that, of course, was the argument that the developers and the county made. What difference does it make? 7 days, 3 days, 9 days? And Bob made a very wonderful point. He said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 7 is not 10. 10 is not 7. The law says 10. And the judges said, correct. The law is very specific. Period. So Bob's brilliance prevailed. And I think we all owe him a huge debt of gratitude.
Did it gall you that the people, the concept of people having, should be able to have a choice about how the very land they live in is developed, you didn't win that lawsuit, but something as minor as a couple of days on a statute somewhere should be the saving grace for something as large as this.
Well, you know, there are many, many examples. You know, a fallen leaf here, a poem there, a nail displaced. History turns on a very strange axis quite often.
How frighteningly arbitrary it can be.
Capricious.
Yes.
All that.
Yes, capricious. So how long...
But the net result is that land, and there's a wonderful model of what the land would have looked like had it been developed with all those high rises, in the visitor center of Golden Gate Recreation Area. That reality is something that we all can enjoy. And of course, you can say, as you just did, isn't it ironic? But there are many, many ironies. Sometimes they work in favor of what you call the arc of justice and tranquility, and sometimes not.
Yes. Well, for those that are listening to this interview and are trying to imagine what that kind of development would have looked like, what they would have had, this would have been a self-sustaining city of, 20,000 people?
At least there were going to be more than a dozen 15-story high-rises, as well as other forms of residential, commercial, and industrial use of that property.
And
it was a very intense development.
I've been around for a while, and I remember what high-rises looked like in the 60s. Not the prettiest buildings.
No, but in addition to that, we went back to the question, is who gets to decide?
Yes, very important.
Why shouldn't the people be allowed, empowered, better word, to make the decision that affects the whole concept of life in our community? The whole experience of community is based on how we relate to nature and how we relate to land, recognizing, as we must, that economics, jobs, pavement, hospitals, and schools are part of our civilization and part of our community life, but there has to be a balance, and who is better equipped in the long run to make those decisions than the people most affected?
So in this particular case, and the fact that there were, you know, individual civilians that participated in this fight, petitions being signed, local activism. This wasn't a fight just between attorneys. This was, the people were engaged in this fight. The people of Mill Valley, the people of Marin County, correct?
Yes. And of course, we obviously have emotions involved. In that first lawsuit where we wanted to have the people vote, we felt it pretty clear that the disqualification of a number of signatures was very arbitrary. It's also, somebody left out a middle initial on their name. That signature was disqualified. Somebody put down a P.O. box rather than an address. That was disqualified. Somebody performed a signature that the clerk said, I can't make it out exactly. That was disqualified. Just enough signatures were disqualified by the trial court, Justice Judge Wilson, even though there were hundreds more than required, just enough were disqualified that the people were denied the right to vote.
Well, that begs the question of, really, this is an ethical issue. I mean, it's just enough signatures.
We felt that, and of course, when you get up in the litigation mode, the emotions can overflow, and obviously we felt very strongly that the deck was stacked.
Yes.
That there was an abundance of signatures, and we had people willing to come in and testify that, yes, indeed, you may not be able to read my signature, but that is my signature, and I want to come into court and say under oath, yes, indeed, that is my signature. I want it counted. And the judge ruled, that's what judges do, calls balls and strikes, no testimony. Be that as it may.
So how did you respond to, personally, how did you respond to this kind of affront? I mean, did this, just your personal emotions, how did you get through all these kinds of obstacles?
Well, you channel, you suck it in. Later, as you know from your conversations with Huey Johnson, also a distinguished Mill Valley long-term resident, that led to the creation of the Trust for Public Land. At the time of all this happening, there was no Trust for Public Land. There was, happily, a Nature Conservancy. And the Nature Conservancy specialized in that type of conservation, it still does largely, for the protection of biodiversity, a very laudable goal. There was no particular biological justification for Maranchello. It wasn't just anti-development. It was community building on nature that existed, but no demonstrable value of biodiversity. As a result of which, we were pretty much, who were involved, strong word but true, expelled from the Nature Conservancy because we were told, don't do this again. We're not in the business, said the Conservancy, of building playgrounds. So we said, wait a minute. So that led Huey and Doug and I and a whole bunch of others to start the Nature Conservancy to bring more balance into the conservation portfolio. So as I mentioned earlier, before we went on record, a lot of our work is urban. We work in downtown Manhattan. We work in Boston Commons. We work in Los Angeles Hills, because it's very important to all of us that we have conservation that is not only, gee whiz, ain't it pretty, look at that sunset, but also bring natural open space to school children and especially to underprivileged people who otherwise wouldn't get to Glacier Point or Glacier in Yosemite or Glacier Park in Montana. We think it's very important that nature and access to open space be readily accessible. And that led to the creation of the Trust for Public Land, which has now done happily hundreds of projects similar to Maranchello in at least 40 states.
Do you think of that right to have access to open space as a civil right for all?
I do. I think it's as important as any other security issue. I think it's as important as a hospital or as a public school, and I think those are very important, as I think museums and symphony halls are. But open space shouldn't be an afterthought. It isn't, you know, land that's left over when we've done all the important projects. I think it's important, and I think that's what the Trust for Public Land represents, that land is not something out there, but it's something in here and in each of us. And there's study after study that indicate the effect on people's health and well-being, their recovery time from hospitals, etc., are demonstrably enhanced by having access to quality open space.
You were the president for the Trust for Public Land, weren't you?
I certainly was. Huey was the first president. And then I think after about 2 years, he was asked by then-Governor Jerry Brown to become the Secretary of Resources, and he left the Trust for Public Land and went to Sacramento for several years as the Secretary of Resources. The second president was Joel Cooperberg, who had worked for the Trust in Florida, and we brought him out from Florida to be the president of the Trust for Public Land based in San Francisco. After a year or so, it became apparent that he had other qualities and interests, and I was persuaded to give up my chair on the board of directors of the Trust for Public Land and leave the practice of law and become the president of the Trust for Public Land in San Francisco, with then offices all over the country, over the next almost 20 years.
And that you took that position in what year?
Probably 1973, 74, thereabouts.
And so for 20 years, that became your life.
I had the consent of my good wife, Joan Rosen, because it took a major pay cut, like two-thirds, ooh, from the practice of law. I was a transportation lawyer specialist representing airplanes, railroads, communities, bus lines, truck lines, all over the country. And through the persuasion of Doug Ferguson, who you've interviewed, and Huey Johnson, I was convinced that it was much more important to all of us, especially me and my family, to become the president of the Trust for Public Land, which I did for approximately the next 20 years.
How did they persuade you, I have to ask?
What
did they appeal to you?
Boy, that was a long time ago. I can tell you where it was in our house, sitting on a sofa in Homestead Valley, and I was looking out at Mount Tamalpais, and they said, the time is now. The time is now. And looking out at Mount Tam, I agreed.
Fueled by the success you'd had with Maranchello, did you feel the hope that you could proceed in some way, in successful ways, not just spin your wheels? Had you been enlivened by that success?
Well, as I said, and I believe, I'm a pathological optimist. It's in my genes. We always look at the odds, but we're not only driven by the odds. Someone said a lot of our victories are temporary, but most of our losses are permanent. And so I'm a great believer in doing what you can, while you can, where you can, and having other people tell you what the record or the legacy was or could have been. So I've just, quite frankly, rolled up my sleeve with a bunch of others, essentially Doug Ferguson. Remember, he was on the board also for all those years. And we basically did what we could, where we could, while we could, responding not so much to national agenda items, but quite frankly, because we felt the local community, such as in Maranchello, were unheard, we set about empowering local communities to have their voice heard with respect to open space needs within their communities. Sure, we had additional criteria and additional agendas on the national front, but we always had a special interest in making sure that smaller communities did not go unnoticed. So it may have been something on Merrimack River, it may have been something on the Fakahatchee or the Chattahoochee or Asheville or whatnot, that may not have been as prominent, say, as Yosemite or some of our signature projects, but had an importance to the community that gave it a quality that we felt had to be respected. And that was our role. And we've done that now numerous times, participating in many, many bond acts where we have raised, and this is not an exaggeration, billions, with a B, billions of dollars for conservation from local communities, state, federal, and local, all over the country.
That's impressive. Very impressive.
As I say, somebody else will do the math. What we did basically was figure out how communities in need, especially communities which were underserved, and those are essentially Latino, Black, Asian, Native Americans, how those voices can be expressed through their land ethic. And the land ethic, which we hear a lot about from Aldo Leopold, you know, is not confined to biological matters only. It has a lot to do with civil rights. It has a lot to do with access to public funding. It has a lot to do with voting. And those relationships were paramount. As I mentioned earlier, if there's anything I'm most proud of is the small contribution that we have made to redefining conservation to include something more than the Gee Whiz, Ain't It Lovely Sunset project. Those almost sell themselves. The Big Sur, Coast, and Avista is very easy to appreciate. What's much more difficult to appreciate is the birthplace of Martin Luther King in downtown Atlanta. That's not exactly a Gee Whiz proposition, but it was very important, we felt, to have that community of color recognized and acknowledged as a national park. And it is now one of the most heavily visited national parks in all of Georgia. That was not the case. And it was not a welcome addition by the National Park Service, who frankly took a while before they recognized the importance of land as land in a community. So that the birthplace and the Martin Luther King home and the Ebenezer Baptist Church tell a wonderful conservation story, as does the schoolhouse that was determinative in Brown versus Board of Education. Now, a lot of people may say, well, what does that have to do with conservation? It has everything to do with conservation, because it has to do with dignity. It has to do with a sense of place. It has to do with a sense of belonging. And working with the Brown family in Brown versus Board of Education, that was probably one of the most thrilling moments of my life, when they joined us and Russ Dickinson, the director of the National Park Service in downtown Topeka, not exactly a Gee Whiz site, to become the Brown versus Board of Education National Historic Site.
The idea of conservation, when we think about how it's evolved over time, have you found in your work and your experiences with other people that the word itself, conservation, is limited in the public view? I mean, the way that most people view it? Because it seems to me you have a more expansive vision of what conservation really is.
You're absolutely right. A lot of people think of conservation as another Yosemite. A lot of people think that conservation is a white man's guilt trip. A lot of people think conservation means taking it away from the Mexicans and the Native Americans who don't appreciate it the way we white folks do. There's no question that words matter, and we have to kind of demonstrate our commitment to something larger than narrow self-interest when we talk about conserving our land, making it available, and putting money up to acquire those properties when people obviously have other priorities. And of course, that leads to Point Reyes and a few of the other places, and how we maintain the balance between the farmers and ranchers of Point Reyes, and not, in effect, just drive them off the land saying, sorry, we have a better use for our land. We want to write a textbook of redwoods, and you don't belong in this land. It's a much more demanding evaluation of land and people that is our concern.
Viewing it from your perspective, I should think that it's such a daunting prospect, because these are such big and complicated issues, that it's simply too much for many people in the expansiveness of what it entails to really, because there's so many different agencies in control of the land, and the individuals that would like to use it, and the corporations and the private sector and all these things. It's very, very hard to juggle and stay balanced with all these different facets.
Well, you're absolutely right. People feel very passionately about their particular point of view. And each of us has the right to be heard. Each of us has the right to be respected. Each of us has the right to work out the kinds of solutions that we think benefit us as members of a community, rather than having them driven by strictly dollars or political influence. It is complicated. And for that reason, we've been at this now, how many years? Going on 50. It's awfully important to listen and not just, you know, arrive by parachute and say, ah, we've done this before, let us tell you how it's done. Every community is different. Every community has passion. Every community has built-in negative determinants. The first thing you hear from the Taxpayers Association, you can count on it. Don't we have enough parks? We have more parks than we can even take care of today. What we ought to do is deal with the backlog and privatize these parks, remembering King Canyon and places like that. Disney can do a better job than the Park Service. These are complicated, and part of the job of the conservation community is not to be patronizing or high-minded and condescending, but to genuinely engage people just like ourselves who feel just as strongly mm-hmm. about their vision or their view. And that respect, in turn, it seems to me, builds a stronger community and builds a stronger America.
Mm-hmm. Especially within an America that has so much diversity, both in the environment and the people.
And, you know, that's not new. It's no secret that Mr. Trump has an agenda which is essentially anti-environmental. But he is not the first. Ronald Reagan was not misquoted when he said, if you've seen one tree, you've seen them all. We dealt with James Watt. We dealt with Justice Gorsuch's mother when she was the head of the EPA. But on the other hand, you don't want to underestimate the goodwill of an awful lot of good people coming together and crafting honorable, effective solutions.
I want you to know, I asked Ronald Reagan about that comment. I was on a television show with him when I was much younger. And I did ask him, I said, what in the world did you mean by that? You've seen one tree, you've seen them all, redwood tree, you've seen them all.
And?
He said, oh, that was taken out of context.
Well, my classmate was Ed Meese, who worked for Governor Reagan, and who was a conservationist. He said that was not taken out of context.
That's what...
It basically means he had a higher priority. You know, if you've seen one tree, what's the difference between one and 100?
Yes.
A tree's a tree. That's his way of saying, and he did say it, and by the people he appointed to various offices, that the environment is not a priority. It's something to be taken for granted. He enjoyed getting out on his ranch and cutting down this and planting that, which is fine, but the environment, the natural world, was not something he wanted to spend any money or time on.
Well, that was, I have to say, that was my take at the moment as well. Did you work with John Krebs with the Kings Canyon
land? Not directly. I was a member of the Sierra Club, of course, and I since then got to know the fellow from Disney who tried very hard to make that happen. But no, I did not have a direct role in that.
Oh. So you're working with the Trust for Public Land. Can you give me an idea exactly how the agency worked? I mean, what was a typical day for you? How did somebody approach you with a project? I mean, were you out looking for particularly interesting cases? I know Doug said that he would get calls arbitrarily out of nowhere, a call with a desperate person, and then he'd jump.
That's right. It worked both ways. We are in the business of protecting the American landscape, large scale and small scale. So yes, we would get calls from poets in Virginia City. We'd get calls from city officials in Tallahassee, Florida. Quite frankly, with Phil Burton, we had an excellent relationship with the congressional committees. And Martin Luther King, for example, was a priority for that committee under Philip Burton. And we were able to serve both the national and the local individual constituencies in a very holistic way. My job as CEO was keeping the balance. We are not a church. We are not a business. We're a nonprofit conservation organization. And you can't do everything, nor can you do everything at once. One thing I insisted on, unlike other people, that we pay our committed full-time employees a decent wage. We never got top dollar, but neither did we ask them to sacrifice their children's medical benefits to work for the Trust for Public Land. So my job, yes, was to keep the balance, listen to the needs of the community, listen to the ideas of the staff, develop the staff, take calls from people like Phil Burton, and figure out what we could do, and quite frankly, quite often, what we couldn't do. I remember one case, we had a large donor in New York City who called up one day and he said, I want you to do this, this, and this, and you have 7 days to do it. And I said, sir, I'm honored that you request that, but I can tell you there's no way in the world we can accomplish that in 7 days. So he hung up and never gave us another dime. So our job is to be realistic, reach, but also make sure that the organization never promised more than it delivered. One of our qualities was tenaciousness. If once we committed to a project, we saw the project to fruition, however long it took. Every project that we looked at, we put a timeline to it. It should take a year, 2 years, or 3 years. How do we pay for it? How do we borrow the money? How do we find the money? What foundations do we ask for grants? What individuals do we hit up for donations? There's a continuous bouillabaisse, if you will, that is brewing to keep the spice and the nourishment alive and well. And that's the job of the CEO, learning how to say yes and how to say no. One of the biggest explosions we had as a staff was when a staff member, a senior staff person, made a commitment for more than $1 million, non-refundable, on a project that was very, very difficult. And I had to tell her, no, we're not going to do that. She quit on the spot. And later she reconsidered and said, I didn't quit. And I said, yes, you did. And the answer is, think before you act. And her termination was effective. Those are the realities of running a very complicated organization over a dozen or more states, bearing in mind the trust had offices in Boston, New York, Washington, Tallahassee, Miami, Houston, Austin, Portland, etc. So there's always a challenge, quite frankly, to keep the lights on and keep the faith with the people who expect to be paid, as well as the communities that you're designed to serve.
What was your employee base? How many employees with all these offices?
Plus or minus 300-400, depending. I think right now in 40 states, we have about 400.
And how about the fundraising? Was there a lot of you reaching? I mean, how did that work with your, how you managed to acquire the funds?
Well, you have to have a mantra. And my mantra was, this is not Bangladesh. This is the wealthiest country in the world. The question is how you find the resources to do the job that you say you're going to do. And so fundraising is in your genes. You have to be continuously fundraising, but not only fundraising. And one of the unique features of the Trust for Public Land is that we tried to maintain, and did for all my years, two-thirds of our funding came from successfully closing real estate transactions. We'd buy land under the Internal Revenue Code. A portion of it would be a donation, and a portion of it would be cash. But we were always what I call the third best choice in town. The best choice being top dollar, all cash. That wasn't us. The second best choice is as much money as you can now. That wasn't us. We would always negotiate very hard, very openly, with the individual landowner, respectfully and in dignity, not cutting any corners, not playing any guilt trips, and saying, this is what we can do, and give us some time to get it done. And we did it again and again, literally hundreds of times. We frankly had a mantra again, we would do a transaction a day somewhere in the USA.
Oh, my.
Now, some of them were tens of thousands of acres. We did a project for the Nez Perce Indians in eastern Oregon. Thousands of acres. That was the home of Chief Seattle. On the other hand, we did projects involving city lots along the Los Angeles River. So it took a variety of techniques. But the main thing was the end never justifies the means. And that's easy to roll off the tongue, but what that means is that nobody was on a commission, nobody promised something they couldn't deliver, and whatever we said we would do, we did. And that astonished a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm astonished right now. I'm trying to imagine that this kind of way of conducting business, it would come, that there would be times that you are facing people that did things quite a bit different. There's graft. Right. I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley. I know how things were done.
Sure.
That you would be hitting a wall of something very different. And,
but I think that's been the key to our longevity. Secondly, we never badmouthed another organization. Ever. And we were badmouthed a fair amount. In the state of Georgia, we were turned down by a foundation because another conservation organization said we were nothing but a bunch of real estate brokers and they shouldn't do business with us. So when we went in there, we asked for the grant. They said, no, we know all about you. You're nothing but a bunch of real estate brokers pretending to be conservationists. We thanked them. We left with all dignity. We never said a word about that organization bad-mouthing us so that they would get the grant rather than we. That happens all the time, unfortunately, you're dealing with people. But your destiny is literally determined by your integrity, period. Non-negotiable. Never a bad word. Does it work? So far, as Stevie Wonder said, are you blind all your life? Not yet.
Did you ever feel that you were riding a wave of opportunity? I mean, things during the 60s and 70s, I've talked to Huey about this, and when he was working with Jerry Brown, and there was, he describes opportunities that he had that in some ways doors are closed. I mean, did you ever feel that you were riding a wave of an era where conservation was blossoming and growing and as a part of a new kind of living, and that those doors have closed? in recent
Not
years?
Really. Our model, because as I say, we dealt with James Watt and we dealt with Ronald Reagan and a bunch of people who, quite frankly, were out to undermine and even deprive of us. Several people tried to get our nonprofit status canceled by the IRS. We met a lot of challenges that way. Our mantra is very simply, do what you can, while you can, where you can, rather than trying to pretend that we could see historical forces at work. We frankly would expect someone else to write the book. We were very busy keeping our head down, responding and offering services to people around the country who shared the vision of Aldo Leopold's land ethic for all of us, and Frederick Law Olmsted, and Thomas Jefferson, and Chief Seattle. There are a lot of here, and Martin Luther King, again and again. So there have been clearly, as we are now experiencing, tough times, hard times, but I've never seen it fit to put these things in historical terms beyond, quite frankly, our opportunity to do what we can, where we can, while we can.
I guess you've got a very honed ability to switch it out as needed.
I'd say that's fair. That's fair. Having been a lawyer, I learned early on there's no case that couldn't be won, and there's no case that couldn't be lost. And the difference quite often is, as it was in Maranello, a sliver of 3 days. So what you do is what you can.
You've got a wonderful attitude. Have there been people that have inspired you or been mentored to you that have helped you to develop this wonderful ability to go forward even against untold odds?
Well, many, many, many people come to mind. Aldo Leopold, of course, talks about ethics and the land ethic. That's basic. Frederick Law Olmsted, clearly. Thomas Jefferson, in many ways, not every way. Huey and Douglas, daily. Many, many people. Phil Burton. So many really wonderful people reinforce the basic humanity that we feel, and how much we are, quite frankly, advanced by their transfer of energy and hope that we absorb and feel nourished by. Many people, many people.
Although you're so optimistic, has there ever been a time where you felt gutted by the result of something? You know, lost a little of your hope or felt down for as a result of something coming out not the way you'd hoped?
Well, I remember one particularly dark period. We were at the Hotel La Fonda in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a board meeting of the Trust for Public Land. And finances were, I cannot tell you exactly the year, but I can give you the setting, that finances were very, very precarious. And Douglas was on the board, and we were good friends and trusting. And he has one of the most brilliant senses of humor of anyone I've known. He said, you know, Marty, you're basically going out of business. And, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world. You should have no guilt that a lot of people go out of business and they pay their bills, and that's the honorable thing to do. And then you turn out the lights. And the truth is, I looked at him and I said, Douglas, if that were true, I would turn out the lights. But it's not true. We're going to keep the lights on. We're going to find a way. And Douglas chuckled. He said, by God, I bet you do. And we did.
This is Doug Ferguson.
That was a very memorable moment. And neither Douglas or I have ever forgotten it.
And that's Doug Ferguson you're talking
that's
about.
That's Douglas Petter Ferguson. One of the best friends anyone could ever have. And his wife, Jane.
Yes, very nice people. What would you say to people nowadays, younger people, that are graduating from school with debt, great debt, trying to go into the conservation and in this political climate? How do you rally the enthusiasm and the spirit with people coming in, your own employees and also youngsters that may be coming up and out in the world?
Well, number one, the work is important. It's not an afterthought. It's not a hobby. It's a career, and it's a way to express your best self with passion effectively. And there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of work to be done that requires thoughtful, competent, dedicated people who can and will ultimately make the difference. We've seen it before. We've faced all kinds of adversities. We've faced all sorts of calamities. And the truth is, this too will pass. That if you are fortunate and dedicated and mobilized, you will prevail. You will prevail, just as we have. We brought it to a certain point. The work is really that of a startup. We're just getting started. The trust right now is strictly United States oriented. There's a lot of ways that we can connect with other communities, especially underserved all over the world. We have trained some of the people coming to the United States about what we do. I remember we had a friend come over specifically from Romania to study how we worked and how the Park Service and so forth is oriented. There's a lot of unfinished business. It's really a startup activity. And if you have the passion and the patience and the drive, you can make a huge difference.
Now, you are retired or are you still working?
I call myself gainfully unemployed.
You're not in between opportunities. You're actually gainfully unemployed.
No, I'm still involved actively with two nonprofits. One is called the Pollinator Partnership, which is dedicated to the protection and preservation of birds, bats, butterflies around the world. And that's a largely data-driven academic organization that protects the pollinators that are so vital to our food supply, that are imperiled by the loss of habitat and by the use of pesticides. That's based in San Francisco and in Washington. And I'm on that board, and I'm the vice chair of Pollinator Partnership. And in addition, I'm involved with EarthShare, which is the national organization that represents about 450 conservation-oriented nonprofit organizations, from the Sierra Club to the North Carolina Trout Fishing Association. It's a way that we can learn from each other best practices and communicate lessons learned and leverage experience around the country. That's D.C.-based.
And all this from the Carmel Valley.
All this from Carmel Valley. And personally, being gainfully unemployed, I'm happy to lead hikes and walks every Thursday in the local area. Last week we went to Point Lobos. The week before that we went to Garland Park. Last month we went to Pinnacles National Park, and we have a chance to actually walk on the work of so many people who have come before us.
That is fantastic. So are you the lead guide? This is a hiking group, or is this?
It's a local Carmel Valley hiking group that enjoys going out and experiencing some of the wonders of nature that are right in front of us. You know, the story of Point Lobos having been plotted and developed much like Maranchello, was saved by Frederick Law Olmsted's son, who persuaded the state of California in its brand new national park system to include Point Lobos in that park. There are so many wonderful stories about how people, just like the next recruit, can make a huge difference if he is willing to show the patience and the perseverance to make it happen. In that case, it was the Allen family that made a bargain sale that protects Point Lobos today.
I'm smiling listening to you talk about this. Have you ever just wanted to pinch yourself and say, I can't believe that this is what I got to do with my life?
I said to you early on, it's been the American dream for the Rosen family. Immigrant parents. Dad arrived as a farm boy and hardly spoke English. grew up on the streets of New York until he was drafted and went to France and got wounded. Mom raised after a pogrom in Kiev, in middle America. So they raised two boys, my brother and I, and we have to say, truly, God bless America.
God bless America. I agree completely.
I can see it.
That's a beautiful story. Really, it is. Do you ever come to, have you ever hiked in the Marin Headlands, walked around and just did your happy dance as you looked around with all that yonder all about, all that natural beauty?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tennessee Valley, Dipsy Trail, West Point, Boy Scout Trail, all over Marin County, wherever we could. And that's one of the reasons I so frankly was reluctant to leave Marin County, because every Tuesday I was out on the trail somewhere.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, you
know, you're a lucky lady, as you well know, Deborah.
You mean to be able to
look out your window.
Yes.
Walk, put one foot after the other and say, look at, all I have to do is show up. Well, you don't need a court. You don't need a membership. It's your land. This land is your land.
Well, Marty, you know I own a hiking tour service. And I think,
no, well, you mentioned that. What is that?
TAM Hiking Tours. I give guided hikes in the area, and I think it's both my privilege and my responsibility to share stories such as your story and Huey Johnson's, the story, and Doug Ferguson and Marty Griffin, and all these wonderful people who have given of themselves to preserve the land. Many people take for granted, you know, oh, yes, there must have been some, you know, something had to happen, and this land was going to always be saved, but that's not the case.
Never.
It's fought for tooth and nail, and it's such an important story to share, and that is always a part of what I do, is to tell
it's
the story
wonderful.
Not only of the land and the creation of it and the people and the culture, but the responsibility that we all have when we enjoy this public space.
Well, you're a pretty lucky lady yourself. What a great job. Sure.
Well, it is a privilege and an honor. And as Huey Johnson says, never sit on your laurels. You have to continue to fight. Even what appears to be secure is never really secure. The fight never ends. John Muir said the same.
But I'm not even sure. I understand, you know, the term fighting cancer, fighting poverty. It's not so much a fighting as it is an engaging. We've got to persuade people who we see as opponents and adversaries into joining with us. And that involves listening to them quite often. They have financial concerns. They have experiences or arrogance by a civil servant that has turned them off. We have to engage all of our fellow residents of this planet in ways that can make it constructive for them to join with us, rather than to continue to figure out ways to undermine us. I really believe that. So I don't use the word fighting in my lexicon. I understand that. I think, for me at least, the word is engagement.
I am educable.
And words matter.
And I am educable, and I completely agree with you. Well said. Words have great power. And they set the ambiance, and you make a point of that so well. I appreciate your perspective very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, there are so many things I could continue to say thank you for as a lover of nature.
You said that lovely, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Deborah.
But on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society, and so many people that live in Mill Valley and Marin County, as you know, that enjoy the open space.
Yes.
To you and your cadre of friends and engagers, thank you so much for all you've done and for the time. And I look forward to one day taking a walk on the mountain and finding you there.
That would be nice. Thank you very much, Deborah, for finding me way down here in the Central California coast. I'm very honored and privileged. Thank you truly very much.
And you take care, sir.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Bye for now.